Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you can hear me. No, I really actually prefer to talk standing, but I also like to have notes, and then I might lose my balance, and I can't see the time, and I might overrun, which I don't want to do, so allow me to sit. If at any point I start talking to myself, please raise your hand, okay? It could be talking to myself in many ways, but I hope not. I hope it's technical volume only. Are we okay? I suppose I should say a word about why I'm here, what got me involved in the atomic bomb issues. I was born and raised in Tokyo. I was born in 1947 of an American father who went to the Japan as part of the U.S. occupation after the war, met and married my Japanese mother. Now, everyone here has an earliest memory. You know, it could be a smell, the smell of coffee or whatever. My earliest memory that I can consciously invoke is of my parents arguing over breakfast about U.S. atmospheric testing in the Pacific. And my father, of course, was saying, we've got to do it because of those commies. And my mother was saying, it's so dangerous and it exposes so many people to radiation. I imagine this is in the early 50s, 1952 or so. So that's my earliest memory. And then my second connection with this whole issue that brings us together today is of seeing an image. Many of you may have seen it, but the actual site is much less vivid in Hiroshima. I need to backtrack, sorry. The United States censored all information on the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, did not allow images to be circulated for a number of years, certainly throughout the occupation, till 1952. And these images didn't get around. It's only in 1980 that a number of Japanese citizens pulled their money together to buy 10 feet of film at a time from the U.S. archives. Images circulated before them, but that's the major moment at which moving images come in. But as a 10-year-old or so, with the first TV my family had accessible, I remember seeing a silhouette of a boy sitting on steps, and he had literally been vaporized. And I found that so stunning and horrific that I promised myself then that someday I would teach. And my whole purpose in becoming a teacher would be to keep Japan and the U.S. from going to war again. That was as far as my mind could grasp geopolitics at the time. Now, I have subsequently found teaching a course on the atomic age at the University of Chicago that most young people are simply not horrified by any sort of image anymore. And they have told me so. And it's not completely true because the minute you add captions, they're suddenly vulnerable, which is an interesting thing to think about. But images, they tell me, cannot horrify them. And there's something to that. And there's also, as a teacher who looks for images with which to horrify people, I know that your own defenses or whatever, your own sensibility gets numbed and you keep looking for something more and more shocking, which is not a happy condition to be in. So what I want to do today is to start out with a poem, which for me is the thing that always brings me back to that moment, you know, before Hiroshima, before Chernobyl, or now Fukushima, which is where we always are poised. This is a poem written by a woman in 1952, August of 52, so a very early anniversary commemoration, and she had just seen the first photographs that were made available of the impact of the atomic bomb. And she went to her workplace, was shown the picture, and said, hey, you compose a poem because we're going to commemorate this tomorrow. And she had an hour in which to write this poem. And this is a poem which I translated roughly a few days ago. So let me read you that. It's called Greetings Upon Seeing an Atomic Bomb Photograph. This burnt, raw face of August 6th, 1945. Belongs to one who was in Hiroshima at the time, one of the 250,000 burnt, raw persons no longer of this world. Still, my friend, let us turn to look each other in the face once again. Faces without a trace of the flames of war. Today's face, radiant with health. Morning's face, fresh. When I search there for the expression tomorrow could bring, A shudder passes through me. The Earth holds several hundred nuclear weapons. You walk along the precipice separating life and death. How can you be so serenely beautiful? Listen, can you hear something coming? What needs to be seen is before your eyes. What needs to be chosen is in the palm of your hand. 8:15 a.m. comes around every day. That morning of August 6, 1945, all those 250,000 people who died instantly were, like you, like me, serenely beautiful, caught off guard. That's the end. And more than any actual photograph of dripping flesh or more graphic representations that you can get through animation, this poem has me in its grip still. And it is something that hasn't loosened at all with the internet age. It seems to me that we are always at that moment where we could be caught off guard. And we never believe that this is something, that this catastrophe is something that could come to us. So this image, this idea of our being trapped in this moment, this long, long moment of always being caught off guard, I think applies both to nuclear disaster through the deployment of weapons and through nuclear disaster through nuclear power plants. And I suppose I should also say that this moment isn't one of safety anyway, because the nuclear power plants in their normal operations are always emitting forms of radiation. I want to, and so for that on the Japan side, and for us who are inhabitants of Illinois, many of us, I suppose, there's also the signal connection we have that the first sustained nuclear chain reaction took place on the campus of the University of Chicago. It had occurred to me to be a little curious about why you would be playing around with something like this in the middle of a university campus, in the middle of a city. And it turns out that there was a strike going on at Argonne, and that's why it had to be moved from Cook County Forest Preserve, this first daunting experiment, to the campus of the University of Chicago. And that's why we have Henry Moore's sculpture commemorating that spot, that signal achievement of humanity, plunging us towards total destruction. And the remnants are now in Cook County Forest Preserve, so I recommend that you can find information through Wikipedia. So you might want to take a Sunday stroll sometime through Cook County Forest Preserve and find the two sites where the remnants of the first reactors are buried, the Chicago Pile as it came to be known. But I want to focus not on that physical side of this age, of this early part of our nuclear age, but something else, that there was, that we should all be mindful that there were second thoughts about this almost from the very beginning. And what I'm referring to is the July 17th petition of the Manhattan scientists. How many of you know about this? Yeah, a bunch of you. Yeah, good. I'm glad to see that. This is a petition addressed to the President of the United States, that is to say, President Truman. And do you also know that Truman's grandson, Clinton Truman Daniel, a journalist, 55 years old, is in Hiroshima right now? Has any of you read about that? It's very interesting to think that his grandson is there at this very charged moment. In any case, it is the Manhattan scientists, a large number of them, really mobilized by the Hungarian Leo Szilard, who was very key to the physics that went to developing the bomb, who was running around frantic to get his message to Truman. He got Einstein to cooperate with him, and he had this petition, the July 17th petition, July 17th, 45, so very close, right, to the date. And it reads, the key part of it reads, asking Truman, quote, that you exercise your power as commander-in-chief to rule that the United States should not resort to the use of atomic bombs in this war unless the terms which will be imposed upon Japan have been made public in detail, and Japan, knowing these terms, has refused to surrender. But there's a second following upon that, even so, that in such an event, the question whether or not to use atomic bombs be decided by you in the light of the consideration presented in this petition, as well as, and this is key, all other moral responsibilities which are involved. So this is July 17th, 1945. A number of times when I take up this material in courses, students will say, but they didn't know what it really involved. Well, they knew well enough, these scientists, well enough that they were trying to get the President of the United States not to use this newfound, wonderful gadget. This petition was signed by 71 scientists at the Manhattan Project's Metallurgical Laboratory, a.k.a. MetLab, at the University of Chicago. The mission of that lab was to produce the plutonium for atomic bombs. It was signed by 67 scientists at the Oak Ridge facility in Tennessee, where uranium-235 was separated from 238 to prepare the uranium core for the Hiroshima bomb. 18 at Oak Ridge wanted to modify the end, interestingly, to say that responsibility for use of atomic bombs is shared with our allies. They wanted shared responsibility written in, but they signed the petition. And only two Oak Ridge scientists signed a counterposition petition saying that the Szilard petition was a security risk. And, quote, this is the common alpha and omega that I have encountered in the discussion of the atomic bombs. If we can save even a handful of American lives, then let us use this weapon now, was what the two counter-petition signatories stated. So that is often an issue. It saved American lives, and if we want to really make a strong case, it saved Japanese lives too. An argument based on something that didn't happen, so I don't know how we can make such a strong case. And in any case, whatever the limits of knowledge on the part of the president and others then, we have no excuse to plead ignorance now. I want to briefly address, and I'm going fast, I hope not too fast, because I really want to save time for Mr. Yamada and a lot of time for Q&A, but I want to touch on the question that, or the comment that so many people make after March 11th, 2011, like, why did it have to happen in Japan of all places? Isn't that ironic? And the answer is yes, and at the same time, overwhelmingly no, that it made complete sense that it should happen in Japan, or it could have happened in France, or it could have happened here in Illinois, the most nuclear state in the Union. But it's not. If it's ironic, it's in this sense. First of all, Japanese as well as German scientists were very much involved in developing a nuclear weapon in the late 30s and 1940s. And it's the dual promise that has really been, what to call it, Aladdin's lamp, the sorcerer's apprentice, this dual nature, that the promise of unlimited energy on the one hand and the promise of the capacity to destroy your enemy and, by the way, yourself. And it seems that we have, in the 60-some, close to 70 nuclear years, always played one against, off against the other. So now you see the destructive side, now you don't, and somehow you keep making excuses. It was very helpful for me to hear David Boris talk about arguments presented about, or wariness about taking on the nuclear power issue here. But so there was that imperative in Japan anyway, and also something that often comes up, well, scientists can't be stopped in their quest for knowledge, right? And scientific progress is something so special that no one should get in the way. So there was that to begin with. And then secondly, yes, that devilish phrase, atoms for peace. It's ironic that Eisenhower, of course, as a military commander, thought that the atomic bombs had not been needed. He had a different emphasis once he became president. He saw that once we're in the nuclear age, people use whatever tools they have at hand, so they're going to use nuclear weapons. Nuclear warfare will be was on the verge of becoming normalized, in his view, which alarmed saner heads, as there were back then. And then Eisenhower in France and Britain. And Eisenhower thought, I just don't want to be always being attacked for promoting nuclear war. Hence the Atoms for Peace program, whereby nuclear technology, civilian technology, would be proffered our allies. By the way, in Eisenhower's term, we went from 1,000 nuclear warheads to 22,000. That is under the regime of the man who coined, who announced Atoms for Peace. So keep that in mind whenever you hear Atoms for Peace. And moreover, you know about how we're excited about, hot and bothered about Iran these days. And of course, they, Iran, Pakistan, they got their first nuclear reactors under this program. So as usual, we are right in it at the beginning. There was something astonishing. How many of you know have ever heard of the Stockholm Appeal, 1950? Anybody? Yeah. Huge. I mean, extraordinary campaign. Even if you say the people in the Soviet orbit were all voting, that still doesn't cancel it. 1950 Stockholm Appeal that called for the absolute banning of nuclear weapons. 273.5 million signatories worldwide. Remember, this is before Facebook. 6.4 million in Japan and 3 million in the United States. It comes to coincide with the Red Purge in Japan. It becomes an important part of it, whereby the U.S. priorities switched from making sure that Japan was free of its militarist runaway quasi-fascist leadership to making sure that Japan was a useful ally in our geopolitical programs, i.e. let's make it possible to rearm Japan and so forth and so on. It was kind of swapping prisoners in jail, you know, from the prime ministers, the Class A war criminals, to labor union activists who walked from door to door circulating the petition for the Stockholm Appeal. Unfortunately for the United States, the Atoms for Peace was announced in December 53, March of 1954, with the insouciance of military folk in the Castle Dragon, is that what it was? In the Bravo shot over Bikini, the United States explosion was many times more powerful than planned and irradiated a Japanese tuna vessel along with many other people in the area. And that generated a campaign, anti-nuclear campaign, by housewives, is the language normally used in Tokyo, and again, before Facebook and Twitter, 32 million signatures in 54. This is also when Godzilla develops and so forth and so on. The U.S. and the proponents in Japan who wanted Japan to get nuclear technology, and for the leadership, I am very certain this had to do with being tacitly a nuclear power, not nuclear energy only, but nuclear power. And Americans... many on the American side came up with reasoning of because of Hiroshima, this is the part that's not ironic, because of Hiroshima, therefore we owe this. As Christians, in order to make up for what we did in Hiroshima, we owe them this new technology. So there was that kind of reasoning and a huge PR campaign. The Japanese people were quickly gotten over what was called their nuclear allergy. And that is how we have the nuclear village. We have kind of seemingly completely blinkered and deaf responses on the part of the Japanese government to restarting nuclear energy, the power plants. It is, again, that I think the dual purpose of an energy source and being a latent nuclear power that keeps the 1% in Japan absolutely determined to stay on course. Now, I want to touch a little bit on the social consequences of the disaster in Fukushima, because Mr. Yamada can tell us very expertly about what the material, the technological consequences are and the terrible pickle we're all in. And to do so, I'd like to quote Ms. Muto. She sort of appeared from nowhere and became a national heroine at one of the first large demonstrations on September 19th last year. She comes from Fukushima. She has been an anti-nuclear activist since Chernobyl, which is, she said, after Chernobyl, I started studying about nuclear power. And her reason for her, the first reason she will give you for becoming an anti-nuclear activist is just, I do not want to live off energy that necessarily requires radioactive exposure on the part of other human beings. And she's talking about the whole process from uranium mining, often by indigenous peoples, whether in the United States or Australia. She doesn't want to be dependent on that, on the people who work in nuclear power plants, on the people who transport spent fuel. So I have to somehow figure out a different way to live. And she pretty much was managing to live off the grid and using natural things in her environment to have a cafe, which, of course, she's been wiped out of her means of livelihood. You can find a lot of that, including spectacular slides of her pre-March 11th life, as well as her... did I leave off my own website? I may have. Yeah, no, I didn't. In the middle of your resource sheet, there's something called the Atomic Age, and this is a site I'm maintaining with colleagues. It's a University of Chicago site, which is, again, ironic, right? University of Chicago and its role in nuclear power. You can find a great deal of that information, so please click on that somewhere. But Ms. Muto, in her speech, her theme is we have been divided. I think of her as a very astute activist, too, because she is always warning people, don't set up false enemies. You know, the people who are arguing with you right now about this are not the real enemy, probably. And this is what she said about how we in Fukushima were divided early on. So, quote, caught between the campaign launched ever so quickly to proclaim our safety on the one hand and our own uncertainty on the other, the ties holding us together have been sundered. In our neighborhoods, our workplaces, at school and at home, how many of us have suffered and grieved. Like it or not, decisions are pressed upon us every day, to flee or not to flee, to eat or not to eat, to hang out our wash or not to hang out our wash, to make our children wear face masks or not to force them. You can imagine how hard when your kids' schoolmates aren't wearing face masks to persuade them to wear something that nobody else is, to till our fields or not to till them, to protest to someone, something, or remain silent. All manner of agonizing decisions have confronted us. And this is all overlaid on an increasingly economically stratified society. So you can see that the economic, you know, can you afford to flee or not? Can you afford to buy more expensive, safe food? What can you tell your children? Do you risk social ostracism by complaining to your child's school or daycare authorities that you're worried about their food sources? How can you do that every day? If you're a single mother, how can you have the energy to be informed about what food and water is safe for your child? As Ms. Muto says, people eventually become exhausted and they don't want to learn anymore because they feel helpless. And once you have a nuclear disaster, it's in every pore of your being because you're breathing it, you're drinking it, you're ingesting it through food, and even the places that are not hot spots are also through food circulation and water and air circulation. The whole archipelago, and let us know, we know that the archipelago is not bounded by a magical boundary. The rest of the world is being exposed to the consequences of Fukushima as it was to Chernobyl. So two quick examples of the kinds of things that come up. One is in that region that was within the 20-kilometer range, an ancient, like over 1,000-year festival, ritual of chasing wild horses is being revived at full scale this year. And everyone, at least advertising the site, reporting on it, is very excited. But you have to say, yeah, but who is this good for? Is it good for the horses? Is it good for the tourists it's attracting? Yeah, the tourists bring some money in. Is it good for the riders? Is it good to give the impression that this place is safe? At the same time, as an outsider, what position are you in to criticize something that brings energy and joy to these devastated people? It's a very, very hard place, and there are countless, countless occasions like that. The spreading of debris that's been portrayed as a patriotic act. You're not willing to accept debris from northern Japan. Well, what kind of Japanese are you? Well, if you really care about the well-being of all Japanese people, you keep the debris where it is instead of turning it into a patriotic duty to share in the pain. Don't ruin the whole land. So that kind of problem. Another very interesting article, because usually when we talk about discrimination, and let me tell you that Fukushima makes you get what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in a new way. Discrimination about marriage, for example. Young men in Fukushima seeking women to marry them are having a really hard time. Now, it's curious that it's not women who are being highlighted, because usually when we talk about, you know, worrying about the next generation, it's the women who are condemned. And this is not to say the women aren't in a terrible place, but it's interesting to have the men have the spotlight on them. And I suppose, and they are complaining about discrimination. Well, is it discrimination for those on the young men on the receiving end who can't find young women to marry them through these agencies? Of course, it's experience is discrimination. It is, but for the young women, people, I think we can all of us understand, don't really want to move to Fukushima, right? And this comes back to the government of Japan having so narrowly defined the evacuation zone so as not to have to take financial and other responsibility for evacuating large. So many, 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 many people have remained in Fukushima who should not have. And then you have all these other social ramifications of economic inequities, those who get compensation, those who don't. There you start identifying people to blame who shouldn't be blamed. And now you have men who are feeling bereft of marriage partners unfairly. And it is unfair, but it's not because Japanese women are out to discriminate against them. These are the decisions that you are faced with individually and socially if you have a nuclear disaster befall you. I can't finish, I'm finishing up now, but without having mentioned brought up the cancer issue. The great majority of scientists will say you can't prove a cause and effect relationship between these exposures, even in Chernobyl. And by the way, on the website I pointed out to you, the Atomic Age in Chicago, in the resources, there is a link to this massive Slavic language study. It's Yavlikov, Nestorenko, Yavlikov, which very curiously, the Western language sources, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN people, and others, for some reason, on the Chernobyl accident, don't seem to have been consulting Slavic language resources, which is weird, right? You'd think that they could think about research done in the language of the region where languages of the region where the disaster took place, but you can link to that, where you find a very different picture of the cost of Chernobyl. But so many people will say, from Fukushima, the results are going to be so negligible, it's not even worth setting up a research design. I've read that too. Well, as Dr. Helen Caldicott, one of the founders of Physicians of Social Responsibility, will tell you, you can't say your cancer, my cancer, was caused by this, by Three Mile Island, by the Pacific Islands testing, or this and that. Because, first of all, we live in such a toxic environment anyway, and that these toxins and radiation have a synergistic effect. And I don't know who in their sane mind would not want to try to reduce the toxicity of our environment. Why be content to keep adding radiation to that mix? And I suspect if I were to ask you the question, who in this audience has cancer or has family members or close friends who have wrestled with cancer, I'm suspecting that almost all of your hands would go up. And the organization that first hosted, the website of the organization first hosting Mr. Yamada, called Fukushima Response, and they're hoping to set up chapters around the country. Dr. Carol Wolman, a psychiatrist who's been very active on peace anti-nuke issues, says there are many things we can do to get, and we have to get over our indifference and our fear. And one of them, she says, is we have to get over the social taboo of bringing up the nuclear power plant issue with our friends and neighbors. And I think about what is that fear about? Part of it is fear, right? Fear of cancer. We're all afraid of cancer, although cancer is by no means the only health problem. There are legion others, cardiovascular illnesses and thyroid problems among them. And maybe some of you have heard the expression, the Chernobyl necklace, because so many people have had thyroid problems. There's that fear, and then there's the economic fear. In communities in the United States that store depleted uranium, people don't want people doing research on it because their real estate values will go down. And I think that's also very true for a community siting nuclear power plants. Don't look at the cancer, unusual cancer incidences in your community because that plant is safe and it funds excellent schools for us. I think it's impossible to have individual solutions to this, and that's why we have to think about social and government solutions too. We have to pressure the government into being socially responsible so that we can do something about what imperils us all. So I want to say, how many times as a species can we be caught off guard and survive? And that's the message I'd like to leave you with. And to segue into my introduction of Mr. Yamada, I was talking about this with him in the car because I had read on the Japanese internet that he himself is a cancer patient. And the whole motivation of the Skilled Veterans Corps is to reduce radiation exposure of younger people, but he already has cancer. And I got his permission to bring this up before you, and he said, and yes, in fact, were I not a cancer patient, he's fine at the moment, I don't know that I would have gotten into this. So he has that kind of imperative that's inspired him to take on this task. And then let me tell you more mundane things about him. Born in Tokyo in 1939, he graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in metallurgy from Cream of Crop, Tokyo University in 1962. He's really worked in very high levels of the Japanese corporate industrial world, Sumitomo Metal Industries. He worked in the Central Research Laboratories, the Wakayama Steelworks, the Osaka Head Office. Retired in 1989, but he has been consulting since then, established a print shop franchise. I've been very interested to learn from Japanese internet sources that he was a student activist in 1959, opposing the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, which is it's the security treaty that has blessed Japan with the benefit of America's nuclear umbrella. And back in those days, there were many, many Japanese. People are acting as if Japanese are demonstrating for the first time today, but that's not true. There were different kinds of demonstration, but they did bring out housewives and children as well as students and workers then too to say to be under the U.S. nuclear umbrella actually might be more dangerous for us because it could get us involved in America's wars, and maybe we don't want that. But anyway, that marked his student days. I won't speculate, but I'm very interested in the fact that 50 years later, he's become an activist on different and yet not entirely unrelated grounds. So he has, I guess, about 700 skilled retirees who have joined, who have signed on to his group, Skilled Veterans Corps. Another interview was very interesting for me to hear, which was, for a person to commit to risking his or her life implies that you have to have your family in agreement. And that seems to be a explicit part of the discussion for those who join this group. So with that, I want to welcome Mr. Yamada. Where is he sitting? Yeah.
Thank you, Chairman and Norma. Very good introduction. And thank you very much, all of you, coming here to hear my speech. I'd like to introduce our Skilled Veteran Corps for Fukushima. But before going to that, I would like to talk what is the Fukushima Daiichi now. Today I'd like to speak entitled Facts and Tasks and at Fukushima Daiichi. The reason why I'm talking facts is that there are so many topics, information you have. You are overloaded with the information, and you may not know what is the base, what is more important issue, which covers all of the individual facts, but we have to get the overall viewpoint. Now this is Unit 4. You have seen, you have heard that about the dangers of the spent fuel pool in Unit 4 very recently. But you see the sentence, some 10 people are working on the top floor, and they, at this moment, this, in this photograph, you see that damaged crane is being removed, meaning that this building is rather clean. Of course, it is contaminated, but man can work in the building, and therefore that building has been reinforced already. And even having the huge amount of spent fuel and not used fuel, new fuels are there in the pool, it is already reinforced. In comparison to this, this is Unit 3. That is much more contaminated, and now, up to now, no one can enter in the building. On the top part of this building has been already almost removed from the outside, but inside is very much contaminated. And Unit 2 is the most contaminated. It's count almost 17 sievert per hour. You know that if you get a 7 sievert, you will die immediately. It means that within a half hour, you will die. That is the contamination of Unit 2. And Unit 1 is a little bit better, but it's still 10 sievert. Not millisievert or microsievert. That's a fact. And also Unit 1, 2, 3, there are a lot of spent fuel. The number is much less than Unit 4, but still very much enough to make crisis if they were damaged. And this is so-called seawall. You see, this is just a pile of stone. And I've asked to the ministry whether this seawall is okay or not. Then he said that the TEPCO is Tokyo Electric Power Company, you know, TEPCO estimated that this seawall is strong enough, according to their estimation. But no one can agree to that. This is just a makeshift, temporary facility. They have no plan to install permanent concrete seawall yet. Next, you see this is hose conducting the contaminated water to cool the vessels, Unit 1, 2, and 3. And such a hose system is not allowed as a permanent facility in the production plant or any plant. And this is also still the makeshift, but there is no plan to replace with the steel pipe. They say that the site is very much contaminated with the radiation material, therefore they are not able to install the bases and structures for the steel pipe. But if you see this such pipe horses, if you had the trouble here, you cannot find which valve you should close. It is a serious problem. That's the reason why the horses are not allowed to use in the permanent plant. You can find horses just at the firefighting site, nothing more. And this hose runs from here, and then the cleanup, removing the cesium 137 or 134, and then store it, and then transport it to this way, and recycle to the furnace. The total length of this hose is, say, 2.5 miles. It's an incredible length. Now I'm talking about the reactor vessel. Reactor pressure vessel is the formal name, say, RPV. The right side you see is the RPV at 3 Mile Island. You see that the fuel was damaged or molten, but still remained in the reactor. But in case of Fukushima, the molten fuel breaks the RPV and fell down to the PVC. PVC is a primary containment vessel, we call, and eroded the cement concrete at the bottom. And TEPCO has estimated the depth of the erosion, say, 25 inches. And some concrete still remains until the bottom shell. But there are so huge, big errors contained in the base of calculation, estimation. One is the temperature measured in the vessel, which has certain error because of the accident or explosion. And also, no one knows the shape of the debris, so-called fuel debris. And therefore, there are so many estimation or and in addition to that, the material of the concrete is not uniform. You have to have the mixture of the sand, stone, sand, and concrete. Therefore, uniform erosion cannot be expected. It means that the bottom of the shell of PCV could be damaged. That cannot be detected or checked because though this shell is covered by cement concrete and supported by cement concrete, no one can enter in that. But this is very important. I will talk later. Now, the first work we should carry out is to remove the spent fuel from the spent pool. As you know, there are 1535 spent fuel in Unit 4 and say less than 1,000 spent fuel in other units. And the first the work will be done, carried out at Unit 4 because it's not so much contaminated. But anyway, we have to make the pool, the space in the pool, to take out the fuel debris from the vessel, from the PCV. At this moment, there is no pool, no space. That is the reason why we have to take out the, remove the spent fuel from the pool. And this is the so-called cask, which had weight of the 100 tons, or 200 pounds. And loaded on the huge truck on the ground and exported to the storage yard. But the crane is essential to hang the 100 tons cask. But as you have seen, there is no building which can walk such for such a heavy duty. Therefore, we have to install the very strong structure at the first. Now, at the Unit 4, this work is being carried out. Just a basement has been done already, and within 2 years, the doors fill will be removed. But we have to wait for 2 years, and building is something damaged in Unit 1 to 3, and seawall is like that, and force is so temporary one. And this is a very serious issue. And now I'm talking about the removal of the fuel debris. We have to fill up the vessel, PCV, with the water, because the water is the best sealing material for the radiation. And therefore, it is very essential to fill the vessel. But if there were any damage or at the shell, at the bottom, we cannot fill the vessel by the water, with the water. And as you have seen, this part is cement concrete, and this part is also cement concrete. Therefore, it is very hard to repair this part. And also, there are so many hundreds or thousands of the pipes across the shell, because there are temperature measurement, gas introduction, steam takeout, and water inlet, and so on. So, and inside of this vessel is almost full of the pipes and valves. It's very hard to work inside and outside. And also, inside and outside must be seriously contaminated with radioactive materials, and no one knows how we can work that. But anyway, we have to work. And it means that we have to have this serious radiation exposure. And a lot of works can be done by robot, which will be developed within, say, 10 years or 5 years, 10 years. But the last work shall be done by man. Therefore, TEPCO draws the person. It is very essential. Robot cannot be 100% as human being. That is the very important issue. Now, I'm talking about exposure doses, annual doses, in 3 Mile Island. 3 Mile Island has the accident in 1979, and the cleanup finished within 1789, 10 years, within 10 years. But the fuel debris removal was taken out during the last 5 years. And you can see the exposure is very high during the fuel debris. You can imagine, as I explained, also in the Fukushima, that at the time of the debris removal, we have to have the serious exposure, radiation exposure. No one can avoid that. Of course, we have to make the most effort to reduce the exposure, but finally we have to have. We can never escape from that damage or problem. Oh, sorry, go back. One point, the TEPCO has estimated the human workers' requirement for 5 years. Then they say that at last year they had the worker like this level, but in the future they don't need more workers. But in case of the Fukushima Daiichi, the fuel removal will be started after 10 years. And this is, that means this 5 years means this period. Therefore, in the future, we should have the huge number of the workers. Otherwise, we will not be complete our job. This is the Fukushima. Now, I'm talking about the our organization, SVCF. We appeal skilled veterans and PRO to work at Fukushima Daiichi to reduce the radiation exposures doses for young workers. That is our very simple and clear appeal. And I believe that this is very reasonable and rational, and no one can complain or make other opinion, because that the elder people has much less risk than younger people. Everyone knows that. The reason, there are some three reasons, but it is not necessary, maybe not necessary to explain detail. But anyway, the elder people has less, much less life length remain, and we can work at such a dangerous area. And we appealed this request in April, started April last year. And within 1 month or 1.5 months, we had a meeting with TEPCO and government, Mr. Hosono. And they said that they welcome us, but at that time they said nothing more. And in July, we have dispatched our delegation to the site and inspect the site. I was a member of them, and I entered to the Unit 4, as you have seen at the first. And at that time, we have expected that within some months or within the last year, we will be able to work at the site together with younger workers. But after that, there was no reply actually from TEPCO, from government, and therefore we have asked them and had a meeting several times. But finally, TEPCO said that we have no room to accept you. And then government said that you are welcome, but if TEPCO accepts, so there's nothing to do. And TEPCO doesn't say why, but anyway, they don't have. And also, we went to the subsidiary company TEPCO, who are working for TEPCO in a several portion. Then they said also that even the TEPCO subsidiary company doesn't have the work ordered from TEPCO. The reason why is that those subsidiary companies are prepared to operate the power plant, but not to repair or to work out for the cleanup. Therefore, they don't have the chance to get the order from the TEPCO. What is the matter? And we have discussed and studied a lot, and we have come to conclusion. There are so many reasons why, but this is the most important issue, which which is the obstacles of the our appeal requirement. Now TEPCO is there. TEPCO is now the working or dealing with the Fukushima Daiichi at the site. And some workers of the or employees of TEPCO is working there. And TEPCO orders the job to some prime contractors. But those prime contractors are dividing their order to some tens and subcontract to others. And then subcontract, so on and so on. There are 7-8 layers from top to bottom. And just yesterday, there was some report in the Mainichi newspaper that at the bottom, the one company dispatched the worker to their company, and that company dispatched to the other. It means that such a very low-level companies, some companies may work by themselves, some companies just send a name to upper company, nothing more. And TEPCO has contracts with the prime contractors, but no contracts with subcontractors. Therefore, TEPCO cannot instruct the subcontractors directly. Therefore, and in addition to that, there are some tens of the employees of TEPCO is working at the site, not more. But in total, there are 3,000, almost 3,000, there are over 3,000 workers at the site every day. And there are 400 contractors, actually. This is formally reported by TEPCO. It's not my estimation. TEPCO's figure means, as the average, less than 10 workers are per company. So how TEPCO can accept us? They have only some 10, say 50, 40 companies, people just under the TEPCO's control. This is I believe this is the biggest problem. But simultaneously, this is very traditional system in Japan in the heavy industries like steel manufacturer, as I was, and other manufacturers, construction works, and so on. Therefore, TEPCO by themselves cannot break such a structure. This structure must be very much strange for you, American people or European people, but in Japan, it's very, very common or traditional. And therefore, TEPCO cannot break the structure by themselves. And sometimes, Yakuza, so-called mafia, is working inside. Now, therefore, we are proposing that this site, Fukushima Daiichi site, should be national project. Presently, it's a part of TEPCO's division, but it should be national project, independent from TEPCO. Because I explain a little bit detail one by one, but now I'm talking the four main points. And employee worldwide expertise means that we have to employ the experience from Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And integrated project management is essential. As already you know, we have the multi-layered subcontract system. It cannot it enables to adapt the project management, integrated management is impossible. And also international inspection team. This is quite new, but the working only in Japan, it's sometimes people are very conservative in Japan, and also Fukushima Daiichi is not a matter, not a trouble only in for Japanese, but also for California people or United States people or worldwide problem. Therefore, I strongly propose to form the international inspection team. Now I talk some detail. Firstly, the team, national project team, should be independent from TEPCO. The reason why is that there are so many issues and unknown. As I talked, the inside of the buildings are very highly contaminated, and no one has been inside yet. And no one knows what happened or what is there. And therefore, such project, unknown or uncertain project, cannot be the subject of the profit-oriented company, private company. That should be the national. This is most important, I believe. And under the control of the TEPCO is the power generation and power delivery company, and that company has their own interest for their business, and therefore so many issues, items are covered or not disclosed by such a company, by their own intention. Therefore, we have to have the international neutral organization. Second, project team shall employ the capabilities, knowledge, experiences from all over the world. That is very clear, not necessary to explain more. And integrated project management. This is very essential, I believe, especially for the exposure dose control. We have to have to cover all of the employees, workers at the site, and who is where, and who does what. And for example, if you refer to our proposal, our people had the age and less power, of course, fiscal power. We don't have as young as, but we are able to be at a rather dangerous area. That the allocation of the 3,000 people at the most optimum workplace should be done by such an integrated project management. That is quite essential for the workers and for the future of this project. I mean, this project takes not only 10 years as like Three Mile Island, it takes expected to take 40 to 50 years. It is one man's full lifetime or working lifetime. It means that we have to very carefully control the radiation exposure. Otherwise, we have in Japan 50, at this moment, 50 units. 4 units in the Fukushima Daiichi has been discarded already. Therefore, we have 50 more. But even if the 50 the units wouldn't be operated, but we have to clean up those 50s within some 10 years. Therefore, we have to have the control of the workers at the site very carefully employing our elder people. That is our strong proposal. And inspection team, this must be very clear, I believe. You may know Japanese people are rather conservative and or not having, generally speaking, their Japanese people are very honest to their given task, but not very active or strong to see the with wide viewpoint. Therefore, I would ask the people from United States or Europe to see the fact as it is. And also, in general, the people who is working at the site is very much concentrated to the given task. It's quite normal. Therefore, the person who are very, very much independent from the actual work should be there, and from several viewpoints. I would like to have the international members to supervise, or not supervise, but inspect the activities. Those four are our request or proposal. Now I'm talking or asking you the reason why I'm talking such in the United States. In Japan, we have proposed some of those 4 points already in August last year, but government doesn't hear nothing. But it means, in general, Japanese government is very insensitive to Japanese people, but very sensitive to United States, unfortunately. And I would ask you to spread our SVCS 4 points all over the United States or further in Europe, and ask your government to work to make the pressure to Japanese government. This is our request to you, and it may not work at once, but as I said, this project takes time, 40, 50 years. Therefore, it's not necessary to be early, quick, but taking the time, we want to spread and make the pressure to the Japanese government. Thank you very much for hearing. Thank you very much for inviting us.
So questions, yes, from the very back.
Yes, Mr. Yamada, are there any trade unions you could work with that could perhaps, representing the workers, could help with your group?
The question was, are there trade unions representing your workers who could contribute to this work?
Unfortunately, in Japan, the workers' union is formed as within the company, and therefore the union has the almost same intention as the management. Company management. Therefore, and also that union covers TEPCO's employee, nothing more. And as you know, the multi-layer subcontractor there, the workers at the site are not covered by union. That's a very serious problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, if I may add that that's part of post-war Japanese history where labor was reorganized to be identical to, in other words, company unions were repeatedly formed in a series of major labor struggles in post-war Japan. So we now have this structure. Yeah. And Linda in the back.
We hear that Senator Wyden went over there in the spring and came back and wanted to see that this...
Wyden Joe-in-Gin, Oregon 州の Wyden Joe-in-Gin が、春に... Oh, sorry. Again, sorry. Yes, Senator Wyden went to Japan. He was especially alarmed by the state of Unit 4 and wants to pressure the Japanese government, is also eager to have American and international cooperation in this critical venture.
Yeah, I know.
Contact があったりとか。
And Mr. Wyden talked about Unit 4, but as I explained today, if that Unit 4 is damaged, it's serious, but the probability to have the damage in Unit 4 is much less than Unit 1, 2, 3. Therefore, I'd like to emphasize to not see only the single unit, single aspect or a single issue. We have to have the total system. That TEPCO is, what can I say? TEPCO is working as they like what that makes them easier, I mean, to not make the most preferable They are not taking the most required the way, but most easiest way for them. That's my point.
Has Energy Secretary Chu been there? What has he said? Energy Secretary Chu, 長官が日本に視察に行っていているのかどうか、それで何か言ってるのかどうか発言した。
I don't have.Any information, sorry.
I mean, all we do know is Secretary Chu is very pro-nuclear. Yeah. So,
but I wondered if he had any...
Does anybody have information on that? On Secretary Chu's position on Fukushima? Something to be looked into. Yes?
There was I guess this is good news. There was an article in the Denki Shimbun, I don't know if I pronounced it correctly, July 31st, where they were announcing that there's going to be all kinds of bilateral commissions between Japan, the U.S., U.K., and there's also going to be one from Ukraine where they're going to meet, and it's going to be about the decommissioning of Fukushima. Mm. They're going to meet with some people from the exclusion zone in the Ukraine that, you know, have some expertise having gone through the Chernobyl accident. And I believe that they said, I don't know which agencies from the United States are going to be involved in that, but
IAEA and the
NRC. So there's some talking going on. So, I mean, hopefully, you know, it'll be more than just TEPCO trying to resolve a problem.
国際関係あったかどうか。
2カ国始めましたね。イギリス、アメリカ、ウクライナと。Yeah, this is a recent announcement that Japan is opening bilateral commissions with these four countries and discussions, and whether that doesn't that represent something hopeful, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, that is true, but such a collaboration has been started in the beginning of this year.Already, but it's a very partial collaboration. For example, what would be the container of the spent fuel, and what should be the what type of robot the United States can offer, or like that, and not talking about such a working structure of the working site. And I'm emphasizing working site.Not the so-called general cooperation.
Sorry.
In some of the news, is there news? Are people dying and are people getting sick? The people who are working there?
Our workers dying and getting sick.
Yeah, but the, it's not due to the radiation exposure. Some different reason.
In your proposal to bring other members in your group, you mentioned they are older people, and even though they may be very healthy, they may have other medical issues. So my question is, when you do screening, when you decide who to accept to do the work, do you have doctors, do you have radiation health physicists who can advise you as to the health of the older worker who wants to join? Or, and second part, do you have interest from groups like IPPNW and Physicians for Social Responsibility to help you select the older workers?
So this is a question about criteria for selection of members for the Skilled Veterans Corps and their medical criteria, and who can help. Is there anybody outside helping to screen for suitability? Or
That should be done, but at this, it is very, very, very preliminary or stage. And at the time when we start the collaboration, then we have to screen the people one by one and take care of them, how much they that he or she has been exposed, and follow up later. Such system should be established. But at this moment, nothing has been done yet.
I know that the president-elect of Physicians for Social Responsibility will be introducing Mr. Yamada in New York, so maybe it can begin there. Yeah. Yes? Does the Japanese government own part of TechPo?
Yes. Actually, as the capital, it is owned. But it is owned as the as like General Motors. General Motors has been owned by government, but acted as private company, nothing more. And that is important. And it's actually not controlled by government. Only the matter of the, what can I say, money, the companies is controlled. It is the same situation.
Which also means that taxpayers get to foot a lot of the bill for the problems caused by TEPCO, the wonders of nationalization in this structure. Right there.
So we have this deck here. Is this
correct?
Okay.
これをね実行するにはどうしたらいいんでしょうって。I mean, what do we do to implement these four? I guess that's something that for us all to discuss. Dave?
I would mention one of the flyers there is a little half sheet, and it takes you to the Prime Minister's website where there's a comments section that can be used as part of the letter.
カリフォルニアの経験は、カリフォルニアでの話は。
Yes, I talked with the some senators, staffs, and representative staffs. We have talked.
And in California.
In California. Yes. And the way how to materialize this is very, very big job. And we have already started with at the party, Democratic Party, to break down the detail. But it takes, I believe, 1 year or 2 years more. But okay, we have to start to say this issue, this item, those items, and start one by one.
I had a chance to spoke with one of the organizers of the California events, and who said that the local representatives were sympathetic, but also a little bit puzzled about how they, as local politicians, could impact on what are international issues, diplomatic issues, which aren't their province. And one of the ideas they came upon was, well, let's get in touch with Senator Wyden. For Wyden to know that there's broader interest helps Wyden, too. Of course, Wyden can be informed that Unit 4 isn't the only urgent issue. So that's one kind of thing. And the California organization started up in 2 months ago, and they called on Occupy people too, and they seem to meet every Monday, and they managed to get these political meetings set up with for Mr. Yamada in 2 months' time, which is, I think, truly astonishing and should be inspiring to us here. Yeah.
And also, I'm intending, I plan to meet the Mr. Wyden's staff in Washington.
Let me translate first and then I'll repeat the question so he can be thinking about it. 1、2号機、2号機、3号機の危険を今日強調されたけれども、これ以上この底屋なんかがもっと摩滅したら、どういうことが予期できるか少し説明していただけますか。So the question is, if we should be so worried about 1, 2, 3, what could happen as the containers further erode, as the concrete erodes?、
As far as the present situation is maintained, nothing happens. And there are the risk if we would have the strong earthquake or tsunami, then there may be some damage or serious problem. But as far as the present situation is concerned, nothing happened, I believe. Very stable. That's the reality.
つまり西海岸に到着してる瓦礫やなんかの問題は実際どの程度大きな問題なのか。
どこに到着して
る？西海岸、アメリカとカナダ。
Sorry, I have no idea about that.
But the reality of the debris issue hitting the U.S. West Coast.
Anyway, that the sea stream comes to California, and there must be something, but I don't know what to be.
主流のマスコミは全く当てにならないので、2年間、彼女の2年間の経験で、だから必要なのはもう、インターネットのメディアを使ったり、自分のグループを使ったりするしかない、マスコミはダメだっていうこと。So that was a statement about how it is a waste of energy to hope that our mainstream media will be responsive and therefore the need to use the internet to petition constantly and so forth. So, yes, in the back there. To grow, 妹さん生白州っていう方が福島で何を栽培すればいいかって言ってることをご存知ですか? Do you know about this? I don't know what it is. Is he an agronomist?
Sorry, I'm not focusing to those issues. We are focusing only to the Fukushima Daiichi itself.
Yeah, those are very charged issues about how the agricultural land of Fukushima might or might not be salvaged. You had a hand up. The question was, there's been unionization of a very different kind going on in Japan over the past few years as work has become all of labor, so the majority of labor being reorganized into the subcontractual, very temporary form, and there's an attempt to change the structure of union so you can join as a single person. And so the question was whether that kind of movement is also beginning to meet up with the need of subcontract labor in Fukushima.
I got the information that someone tried to form such a union at the site, but it was not successful. And now he's looking for another way to organize or to make the action there. And it's very clear, I believe, that there is danger and possibility to have the heavy earthquake within some 10 years. But unfortunately, we or I don't have the detailed information about the site condition, and therefore we are not in a position to propose the detailed way or measure what we should take. That's the reason why I'm proposing such international project team independent from TEPCO, and information should be the open. That is the situation.
So I'm sorry, that question was about the dangers of a major earthquake that have been predicted by a number of seismologists. and what the implications of such predictions are, particularly if to shut down just Fukushima Daiichi is thought to take 40 to 50 years. What is the point of having older people work there? Is it that their suffering doesn't matter, or that it won't matter because they're so old already? And secondly, what would be the opposition to that?
I'm talking that the risk for younger people and elder people, that having the same radiation exposure. The elder one has the damage of the radiation comes to the DNA, and that has happened. That happens when the cell splits. But the elder people has much less number of the splits per same period. Therefore, damage to DNA to the elder people is much less. And secondly, the elder people has much less length of the life remained. And the cancer, for example, if DNA would be damaged, the cancer would happen before I, for example, I myself will die by other reasons. And thirdly, that elder people will have almost no chance to make the second generation. And therefore, we will not make any risk to the next generation. Those three are the reasons why we propose elders should replace the young workers. And actually, almost no opposition to our proposal exists. Therefore, government accepts, you are welcome. They have to say so, but nothing, they don't want to do nothing, anything. That's a problem.
Why does the government?
Structure, multi-layer structure I shown, and that is very traditional and normal work style, contract style in Japan. And to break it, you need serious fight among several society, industries, communities, everywhere. You have to be very powerful.
Yeah. Can we have two who have patiently had their hands?
Sure.
Yeah, two. One, two.
So just a comment. I find that offer for just continuing to
be
お礼の言葉ですよね、このコンセプトに対して。それから2011年3月、どんどん廃炉じゃないけれども止められていく間に日本はどういうエネルギー資源を使ってきたのかということで、 So the question, first of all, great, great applause to what he and his colleagues are thinking of doing. The question is, what indeed has Japan been doing, since it obviously hasn't stopped its operations, as the reactors went out of operation for regular maintenance, we should emphasize?
As far as I know, mostly the coal-fired power plant, which was stopped, has been operated again. And also, there are several power saving action has been taking place by companies, by individuals, and in many places.
And last question?
Yes, it's a simple slide you showed up there, and there was one of the scenes you had all sorts of flexible pipe, presumably
Holes.
Water pipes all over the place. Now, I used to work, does atomic radiation have the same effect on
pipes?
That's
clear. For the record, for this gentleman who worked in the swimming pool business, that flexible hoses would last maybe six seasons with chlorine and water. And what about when you have all these other things added to, how long can they be said to last?
Yeah, I agree. Therefore, I'm saying that this is just a temporary. But that TEPCO doesn't have any plan to install the steel pipe.
In other words, the workers aren't aware of how dangerous the stuff is that's going on. But if I heard this lecture first, and then I went to work, and they were saying, well, we're just moving water out of, you know, radiated water, I'd say, you know, see ya.
You're right.